see Dr. Troutman here, so which is unfortunate for me, actually, because he usually sets the stage so nicely around health equity that I don't have to do a lot of work. But since he's not here, I guess I'm going to have to confess to you one of my greatest fears, which is that the word and concept of equity is becoming what we used to refer to as diversity. And I'm concerned about that, because fundamentally inequity in our healthcare system, in many of our other systems of daily life, has to do more with people's lack of access to opportunity, to structured barriers to people's opportunity. And I think that the Affordable Care Act creates a really unprecedented set of opportunities, as were so well delineated by the Texas Health Institute, for communities to hold systems accountable to deliver on opportunity for people. But I think that because we're using the word equity kind of liberally, we're not getting to this concept of power and the need for the other half of the equation. It's one thing for the Affordable Care Act to offer opportunities across a broad spectrum of health endeavor to offer these opportunities. It's a completely different thing for communities to be able to take advantage of those opportunities. In order for that to happen, communities have to be powerful, and they have to be able to participate in the processes that are essentially organizing and redesigning the health systems in their states and in their communities. So that's my fear, and Dr. Troutman is not here to, you know, help make that make more sense to you all, but I will give it a shot anyways. Let's see. Okay, so at the California Endowment, we spent a lot of time trying to shock people. We try to make it clear to people that your zip code is more important than your genetic code when it comes to your health, and it shouldn't be that way, and that we have the tools and the knowledge and the information and the strategies to change that. We just haven't done it, and we primarily haven't done it because, getting back to this concept of power, there are some communities that just don't have the power to participate fully, to level the playing field, to create more opportunities for people. So, you know, I like to say health is political. And when I say political, I'm talking about a definition of politics, which is the struggle over the allocation of scarce and precious social goods. And when we're talking about scarce and precious social goods, we're talking about things like a park or a grocery store, not radical things. But I don't have to say that anymore, because you know, after the Affordable Care Act rollout and all of the years of sort of just incredibly vociferous and hostile aggression towards extending health insurance to all Americans, I don't have to make that point anymore. Everybody knows that this is political. And it's political because there's some big interests involved. So if we're going to use the word equity, we should really be talking about power and the ability of people to participate meaningfully in shaping the kind of systems and institutions that serve their lives. So that's what we're trying to do at the California Endowment. And we spent a lot of time sort of trying to broadcast this message into the faces of people who we think are important decision makers. This is the new air terminal at the Sacramento Airport where all the legislators fly through. And we know that they see this message, which is basically, depending on where your zip code is, your life expectancy can be curtailed, because they call us and they want to know why we're reducing real estate values in their districts. For those of you who were at APHA last year, you may have seen the Metreon building literally festooned with this image, again, to sort of shout from the mountaintops that this is still the case today as we speak. There are profound disparities in life expectancy and educational attainment throughout our country. You can find in the same city life expectancy differences on the order of 25 years, a quarter century, in the same city. And so my fear, again, is that people are going to say, well, we got this equity thing covered. You know, let's move on to something else. fundamentally, the opportunities being laid out here are ripe for picking. Okay, so the CDC defines health equity as when all people have the opportunity to attain their full health potential, and no one is disadvantaged from achieving this potential because of their social position or other socially determined circumstance. And what we've translated that to is that there are a couple of things you have to do when you're trying to develop an equity practice. One is you have to understand, how did we get to the status quo? It didn't just arise overnight. These problems were incubated in structures for generations. And therefore, the solutions have to take a long view. There's no 18-month health equity plan. We have to figure out, how do we look for every opportunity on the horizon to try to slightly reframe or slightly reposition communities to participate more effectively in decision-making in those settings. We also have to be very aggressive about making sure that the communities that are most impacted by health inequity have the opportunity to participate in the redesign of these systems. The healthcare system as it's designed right now for most people, low-income communities throughout the country, doesn't work for them. It wasn't designed for them. It was really designed for people like me who are practicing internists. It was designed to make my life easier, to organize these communities according to ways that I would understand them, but not to organize the healthcare system in ways that they would understand it. And there are a number of opportunities in the ACA to actually change that. Okay, so let me quickly talk a little bit about building healthy communities. And I'm going to mention this because, A, it's a billion-dollar, 10-year bet that we've made that we can improve the health of 14 low-income California communities more effectively by investing in the so-called social determinants of health than we could if we invested purely in health care services. There's overlap there, but not as much as you think. And the reason I say this is because when we created Building Healthy Communities, the Affordable Care Act was really not on the table. It was not something that we anticipated would happen. And it's actually in our mission to improve access to health care for low-income Californians. And so when the Affordable Care Act came along, we actually had to pivot and figure out, how are we going to do everything we can to implement the Affordable Care Act effectively and meaningfully in the state of California. So we went to our board and we said, look, we know that we asked you for $1 billion to do Building Healthy Communities. You think you'd give us another $350 million over the next 4 years to implement the Affordable Care Act? And our board, in their wisdom, said yes. This is an unprecedented opportunity to do that. And so our approach has been primarily on outreach and education, also on workforce, which I'm going to talk a little bit about, and then on what we call bending the cost curve, which is trying to facilitate innovations in the healthcare delivery system that increase access and reduce costs. And I'm not going to talk much about that because I don't have enough time. So we decided in our outreach that we were going to focus our efforts on the Latino population in California, primarily because the Latino population is the highest proportion of uninsured, the highest number of uninsured, and that there is a tipping point in California politically where the representation of, in the state, various houses is now being heavily influenced by the Latino vote. And we think that it's important as a counterweight to the negative messaging that's been coming out around the Affordable Care Act from the East Coast and moving west rapidly, to actually tell the story of a successful rollout of the Affordable Care Act in California. And we thought that that was most effectively done by ensuring that Latinos understood what was in the Affordable Care Act and saw a benefit for themselves. So Building Healthy Communities, again, is 14 communities around the state. We're testing this hypothesis that if there's equity in the Affordable Care Act, we're going to find it, and we're going to position our people to maximally leverage it. Our belief is that human capital is the greatest asset we have in health. Okay, so we all know that healthcare only plays a small role in contributing to overall community health, and there are other factors, genes and the environment and lifestyle. This was a 1993 seminal article by Bill Fahey and McGinnis. Fahey and McGinnis. And we know that life has changed a lot since then, and our understanding of the role of environment influencing lifestyle, and of course the role of an environment interacting with biology through epigenetics, has emerged, so that this is overly simplistic. But what hasn't changed is the contribution of health care to the overall health status of a population. Okay, so this was our press release. We said we're going to push out $78.2 million into workforce in California to try to implement the Affordable Care Act. And our goal was to do it in a way that mirrored these principles of equity that we were trying to espouse. Just to get to the scale of the problem, our Office of Statewide Health Planning and Development in California, which really is our state health policy or institution, estimated the need in California is for 2,500 new physicians annually. Our medical schools total put out about 1,000 medical degrees a year, and only about 15 to 20% of those medical students end up working in primary care. And that's primary care defined fairly liberally. It includes internal medicine, which quite frankly is not really primary care anymore because a majority of those physicians subspecialize. And then California issues about 900 licenses per year to nurse practitioners and about 300 to physician assistants. So the gap is actually quite huge that we're trying to address just in primary care. In terms of representation, a third of California's 36 million residents are Latino, but only 4% of doctors, 6% of dentists, and 4% of RNs. As far as African Americans are 6% of the population in California, but only 3% of its doctors, less than 2% of its dentists, and 4% of its RNs. So these are huge gaps, huge, huge. And they didn't develop yesterday. And they won't be corrected tomorrow. So we have to think about the long arc. Is how do we change this? It costs about $250,000 to train a physician in California. So if we were going to invest just all of our money and try to train physicians, we probably wouldn't get very far very fast. So we have to think much more broadly than just thinking about primary care physicians. So we developed these guiding principles. One was to focus on the triple aim, increase access, lower cost, and improve health outcomes at a population level. Two was to focus on medically underserved places that have high rates of health disparities. And by focusing, by looking at the systems that serve them now, looking at the populations that live in those communities, and figuring out ways to create health opportunities for the people who live now in those places to access care in the systems that exist and to serve as healthcare providers, the people that live in those communities. Three, to facilitate employment and career opportunities for boys and young men of color. And we're really bullish on this. We think that if this proposition is to be true, we have to prove it by showing that we can benefit young boys and men of color with healthcare careers, with access to healthcare, and they can participate in these essentially redesign healthcare delivery systems in a way that's meaningful to both their medical needs and their career needs. We also want to focus on improving the workforce cultural competency and aligning language access aligned with the communities that they're serving. Four, we want to improve the ability of educational systems to incorporate effective youth-centered perspectives and strategies that motivate and support students in pursuing health careers. Again, we're taking a very long view of this. Five, prepare the health workforce to lead the transformation to an integrated health system model that emphasizes prevention, public health advocacy, primary care, and community-based services, and coordinated care by multidisciplinary teams in patient-centered medical homes. Six, build on existing investments that we've made in looking at the school climate, looking at how young people, particularly young boys of color, are treated in the school system, trying to curtail the school-to-prison pipeline, looking at school wellness and comprehensive supports for students, and then finally focus on sustainability by incorporating leveraging into all strategies from the start. So those were our guiding principles. We have a lot of experts helping us shape our work, a group called JFF out of Boston, Jobs for the Future, and the National Fund for Workforce Solutions has been partnering to try to create these regional collaboratives to optimize essentially health career pathways in communities, looking at K-12 systems, community college systems, and most importantly, having the health employers, particularly primary care employers, engaged in the design and implementation of these programs. You've heard about the Texas Health Institute, which we think is just doing exceptionally great work in characterizing the opportunities in the Affordable Care Act and beyond. The Hitachi Foundation has been specializing in trying to figure out how to stimulate these local collaboratives to optimize, again, the local resources. And then finally, UCSF Center for the Health Professions has done these exhaustive reports looking at every category of health professional in the state of California and projecting the future needs going forward. The lessons for philanthropy are that we have to invest in the long haul. There's too much short-termism in this work. People think that they can achieve a meaningful change in 18 months. It makes no sense, and I include philanthropy in that. Philanthropy typically invests short-term in this. We should be investing long-term in these efforts. We should, at a minimum, be thinking we're going to put a decade's worth of investment into a program or set of programs to try to build the kind of pathways and pipelines that we need. Okay, so very quickly, what are we doing? So we're trying to, we realized two things. One is that when we pivoted and saw the Affordable Care Act on the horizon, we said, we got to move fast because this thing's going to hit us like a ton of bricks. California is not ready for this. We already have huge access problems. We already have huge problems with lack of underrepresented minorities in the health professions. So we have to have a combined strategy, one that deals with the short term, something that deals with the intermediate term, and something that deals with the longer term. So the short term was we turned to our friends at the state and said, look, you've got programs to fund both training slots and scholarships for people who choose primary care careers, particularly family practice. We know that every year you get applications and you have a limited set of money. We want to fund the difference between the applications that you get and the amount of money that you have. So we just said, we're just going to push that extra money through your existing system so we can actually speed up the number of training slots in California for primary care practitioners and to enhance loan repayment for those that choose that specialty. That's the short term. And it's very expensive. We're putting about $50 million over 4 years just into that. But we recognize we also, because we have this supply-demand issue in California, as we do in all of our states, the supply of primary care physicians is important, but the demand of our populations on our healthcare delivery systems that are structured so that primary care doctors are really kind of the critical linchpin to access, we have to change that equation. We want to broaden open the doors of the primary care delivery system by using frontline health workers across a much broader range of capacities. So we're making a deep investment in the training and so-called internal career ladders for frontline healthcare workers so that they can see for themselves essentially a pathway to ascend within the institutions that they're currently practicing in. And then finally, long-term, we're looking at supporting and enhancing healthcare career pipelines. I'm just going to summarize this very quickly, and hopefully because Dr. Troutman didn't show up, we still have some time for questions. We do good. So primary care workforce in California, we have this thing called the Song Brown Training Program for health professionals that was set up by the California Medical Association. We are just supplementing that work to try to enhance and optimize the sort of the pipeline for primary care practitioners. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. Our focus is really to try to optimize family practice, general internal medicine, and general pediatrics, also to focus on nurse practitioners and physician assistants. But then to just pick and choose those programs that actually have a documented track record of placing underrepresented minorities into primary care careers. Because our track record across the state of California is very mixed, and we want to reward success. With allied health professionals, we want to build on the work of the National Fund for Workforce Solutions. For those of you who are engaged at all in looking at frontline health workers, if you haven't heard of the National Fund for Workforce Solutions, you should really take a look at it. These are multiple regional collaboratives around the country that have looked at ways to optimize both pathways for frontline health workers as well as internal career pathways for frontline health workers within the institutions in which they're working. We're supporting education and training scholarships for frontline health workers and building on the work of these regional collaboratives. And then finally, healthcare pipelines and pathways. We divided up the state into eight regions. We've done a quick scan of those eight regions to figure out who's doing the best work. We recognize that the best work in this pipeline work really, it has to include employers. Employers have to be at the table shaping essentially the design of these pathways. And then they're much more likely to actually hire the people that are products of these pathways. Our strategies are focused first on opportunities for boys and men of color in California, because we think if we can't get that right, there's no coming back to it. You've got to start with that and optimize that in your design. And then we're focusing on a heavy emphasis on mentorship and exposure to work settings. Okay, finally, if you want to practice equity, you have to believe in building power and access. People have to participate meaningfully in order for there to be real change. And my fear, again, is that equity becomes the new diversity. It's just about having programs and, you know, words in documents that say, pay attention to this. Equity can't become the new diversity, because we won't solve these health problems if it does. We have to look at the key structures that are producing the status quo and systematically dismantle them and reassemble them. We have to enlist the participation of those that are most impacted so that they have a meaningful voice in what the system looks like. We're taking actually a group of our communities, resident leaders, health practitioners, community clinics, some of our public health staff, to Cuba to take a look at a completely different design for a healthcare delivery system at the community level. And we're saying, learn from this, come back, and try to redesign what's happening in your communities along the lines that you think makes most sense for the people that need access to healthcare. This is not going to happen overnight. Thank you.
So we do have time for a few questions. Lo and behold, yes. Yes, could you say who you are? And I would be a fool to say that there aren't other agendas, but I think it's primarily couched in political terms. I see, though, that through history there is a precedent for this approach. I mean, it happened with Medicaid before. There's been resistance on the part of the states. This is it's kind of a classic example. It may have certain geographic patterns that are maybe different from the way they were before, but there are, from what I know about the history, I think this resistance is not atypical. I think it is generally embedded in politics with other excuses around it. I've heard from time to time there are certain states, like for example Mississippi, who feel that they could struggle even on the 10%. That they'd be required to up. So there is this, there are, when you say politics, though, that is fraught with all sorts of other dimensions. There are other dimensions about philosophies toward taking care of yourself up by your own bootstraps. There are other undergirding issues that inform and feed the politics behind it. So the sense of what are we doing, giving out things to people, you know. So you have to keep that, I think, in mind that that term politics can be an encompassing term, that underneath it can be these other issues about how people, what people deserve, the deserving and undeserving poor kind of approach to things. And finally, just to answer your question, I take, I have a couple of guidances. Watch Kentucky, watch Arkansas, because there, and I'm not saying there aren't others, but Kentucky, Governor Beshear is forthright. You look at John Kasich and what he's doing in Ohio. Look at the oddballs. That's what we say, these states that are not the most progressive, but these other states in between that are kind of trying to figure it out and are figuring out to some extent, might be the harbinger in a positive way of what some other states might do. I mean, tell me if Kentucky's not doing well, that Mississippi and Tennessee are going to say, you know, that's a little bit harder in both the political realm and the person realm to justify if they say, you know, Kentucky's doing well and we're not, because then you're seeing the likes. You know, it's the old story about we can't do it in our turf. Well, we're doing it. Well, how'd you do that? Well, you are doing it. Well, so, maybe I need to rethink this. I've run into it in a number of other quarters, and maybe it can show up here as well. Yes, ma'am. Could you tell who you are, please? Tony, could you answer that as someone who is in California? I could speak to it from a distance, but I think I'd like Dr. Eichen perhaps to respond to that.
And I'm happy to talk to you afterwards as well. You know, my sense is probably the patient-centered medical home is probably the media's target for you, looking at different kinds of designs for service delivery. Looking at, you know, possibly even training and employing some of your patients as community health workers, and engaging in different sort of forms of practice, like group visits and, you know, more sort of community-based kind of interventions. I think that there's a lot of room for experimentation under the Affordable Care Act, and California is going to adopt sort of the expanded medical home model. And is in the process of designing what that looks like right now. So there's real opportunities to think about that and think about it from the perspective of your patient population. Again, I would spend as much time as possible trying to get them to tell you what they think they need so that it's as informed as possible. But that's where I would start.
Dr. Grazia, do you have any thoughts?
I'm glad that Dr. Eichen actually mentioned the community health workers because I do think that that's, when we talk about the workforce, certainly you can talk about the physician workforce, the nursing workforce, and investments that are being made there. But I think even, for example, through the Innovation Center, for example, looking at those types of population health approaches, really looking at teams that kind of go out
I might also suggest for references for the ACA that we have copies of our reports here where the patient-centered medical homes is brought up, talking about collaborations and leveraging opportunities. So you might want to pick up some of the reports that you can kind of wend your way through them and see where those opportunities might pop up. I'll tell you about one more question if there is one as we're at that time. Two more questions if we have. Just a little bit. I think many of the remarks from Dr. Eitan and Dr. Gracia, as well as our approach, is very consonant with what you're talking about. It's where people live and work and engaging, empowering, and bringing them and addressing community-based change that in some ways involves but goes far beyond the healthcare system. So you have one more question. That's it.
We're over time, so
okay.
I'll call you.
Okay. Well, I thank you for your attention and attendance, and I thank the panel very much.
I go to ethics conferences, and I find that tone.
used to being around tenured professors where they can actually speak their minds. I do believe that were no one voting for these folks, and that were they not having to go on record being against everything Obamacare, it would be a no-brainer. Of course they accept the Medicaid expansion. You can have a view of teach a person to fish and still accept, you know, money coming in to attend to, you know, the people of your state that are languishing. It's appalling to me. I'm a lot less forgiving than you are.
It's appalling to me, too. I just have to be a tiny bit tolerant
about it. I appreciated your colorful description of the great state of Texas. Thank
you. Dr. Shaw, I'd like to shake your hand.
How are you?
You would. I know that you're rising on the ranks.
Amir.
Let me come down there.
Hi.